What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Ken Spiro, Aish HaTorah Senior Lecturer in Jerusalem, and dynamic author and speaker on Jewish history. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom, L'shana Tova, Gmar Chatima Tova. It's a new Jewish year, just 9 days old, which means we are in the last days of the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days of repentance from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, from the Day of Judgment to the conclusion of the appellate process on the Day of Atonement. This Jewish season is always a time of exaltation. That's why they call these the High Holy Days. But there's also a certain sense of pressure. We're in the midst of these days of repentance, and we try to right the wrongs we have done over the past year and reconcile with anyone we've injured or offended. It's a challenge to heal our actions from the past 12 months, and it is perhaps a greater challenge to try to change the habits we've fallen into that lead us to do things we are not proud of. Our goal during these days of awe is to look honestly at ourselves and to ask God to forgive us those failings we have committed in the last year, and so to become whole. But as the Talmud tells us, for sins against God, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, atones. But for sins against other human beings, the Day of Atonement does not atone until we have made atonement to them personally. God cannot heal the breaches in our relationships. Only we can do that by going to the people we've wronged and asking them to forgive us. So this is the most important time of year for us morally, a crucial period of reflection, self-examination, and what Israelis call cheshbon ha-nefesh, taking an accounting of our souls. On Yom Kippur, the fast day of atonement, holiest day of the entire Jewish year, which begins tonight at sundown, we commit ourselves to try to repair our own world through repentance, prayer, and charity, tshuva, tefila, utzedaka. The melody that captures the essence of Yom Kippur best is also the only melody that people come to temple just to hear, the Kol Nidre, the renunciation of failed vows that begins the night of Yom Kippur. It's the melody that for many people captures the heart of the Jewish experience in just a few moments of music. Here's the great cantor Moshe Oysher's rendition of the beginning of the Kol Nidre.
Oh!
That was the remarkable Moshe Oysher's Kol Nidre for Yom Kippur, coming tonight. Kol Nidre is designed to bring us close to what is holiest within us. And at this time of atonement and return, we do well to remember as well that holiness begins for Jews with personal actions, with mitzvot, not simply words or professions of faith. The way to improve the world is by doing acts of goodness, blessing, and courage, not talking about them. Not even with God. That's what we dedicate ourselves to this time of year, actions that matter and can improve the world. Nonetheless, we need to ask God for help. And that's never more clear than in the Kol Nidre's soaring conclusion. Here's cantor and opera star Jan Pierce singing the end of the Kol Nidre. You know, we could do a whole show on the melody of Kol Nidre, its many interpretations. We could tell famous stories about Kol Nidre Eve, jokes about Kol Nidre, and so on. But the truth is, the only way to truly appreciate Kol Nidre is to hear it live, in a synagogue, on the eve of Yom Kippur, in a room filled with fervent prayer, soaring music, white clothing and tallises, and the power of the great day of atonement. It's a truly amazing experience, and it takes place just one night a year, tonight, at a synagogue near you. Or, in this year's very unusual circumstances, if, like most people, you are not attending my own strictly limited congregation at Beit Simcha, if you can't be physically present, then watch it and hear it live on Facebook or YouTube or Zoom. You can even join me on Beit Simcha's Tucson Facebook page for this very special Kol Nidre. All of it is there to bring us to tshuva, repentance, and to help us learn how to work to heal injustice and brokenness in our lives, in our country, in our world. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Ken Spiro, Senior Lecturer for Eshat Torah and a dynamic speaker on Jewish history, will tell us just why Jewish history matters. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days are, of course, here. You might have missed Rosh Hashanah, but Yom Kippur comes up tonight. Join Beit Simcha for our blended online and very limited live seating. You can call 520-276-5675 or email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are normally open to everyone in these days of coronavirus sorus. Join us every Friday night, including this Shabbat of Sukkot, on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat Sukkot services this week are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. We'll hold services with full music by virtual experience weekly for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access them by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information, or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Find out about our services, great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and incredible array of adult education academy courses, all taught on Zoom, and our services on Facebook. Call 520-276-5675 for Congregation Beit Simcha. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Art guests this morning. Rabbi Ken Spiro is senior lecturer and researcher for Eshat Torah in Jerusalem, a licensed tour guide, author of a couple of really interesting books on Jewish history. We want to talk about his approach to that. And, just an all-around fascinating guy. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
It's actually good afternoon for me, but good morning to you, because I'm speaking to you from the old city of Jerusalem.
The holy city.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
The holy city.
Tell us, how did you get involved with Eshat Torah initially, and what does Eshat Torah really do?
So my story with Eshat begins many decades ago. I was actually raised in a non-observant family. My kids, who were all born in Israel and raised very Jewishly connected, speak Hebrew as their first language. You know, my son asked me years ago, he said, "Dad, what did you used to do like Jewish stuff when you were little?" I told him, "I used to have ham and cheese on matzah during Passover." So... at minimum, Jewish.
Not recommended by rabbis in general, I'm just saying.
No. Yeah, my family wasn't Zionist, didn't visit Israel as a kid. This is B.C., you know, before birthright, so we didn't have, I never had a trip to Israel or anything like that. I actually went to public school in the Rishon High School. I went to Vassar College. I studied Russian language and literature and Japanese in university, and I could... by the time I finished, I could read Tolstoy in Russian, but I couldn't speak it. So I went as a graduate student to the University of Moscow during the bad old days of the Soviet Union, because I wanted to get the immersion in the language before going off to business school. And it was in Russia that I actually met all these Jews who were risking their lives to be Jewish. you know, secretly studying Hebrew, secretly keeping Shabbat. I was planning to go to Israel for a few months just to learn Hebrew and hang out in kibbutz before going off to grad school. And in the end, I decided there's got to be more to this Jewish stuff than I've been exposed to, so maybe I'll go learn a little bit. So I checked into Eish HaTorah, which is an international outreach organization that's whose center is based in the Old City of Jerusalem. I was going to stay for 3 months. My 3 months have now turned into 38 years. And I stayed. I studied full-time. I became a rabbi, something I never planned to do. And I got a master's degree in history, and I'm a licensed tour guide, and I sort of am one of the few guys who's a rabbi, tour guide, historian, author. And basically I do that. I act as a I teach part-time in Eish HaTorah, and I'm also guiding and going on speaking tours around the world and writing books occasionally when I have some free time.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Ken Spiro when we come back about Eish HaTorah, but also about his own work and his approach to Jewish history, which is quite unique, when we return in a moment here on 2 Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email me at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. For the still pretty new year of 5781, we welcome a randomly recurring feature of 2 Jewish, Zen Judaism. In nature, there is no good or bad, better or worse. The wind may blow or not. The flowering branch grows long or short. Do not judge or prefer. Ask only, is it good for the Jews? That was Zen Judaism, Haikus for Jews, Kohans, Koans of Wisdom on 2 Jewish. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Gemar Chatima Tova, may you be sealed in the Book of Life for a good year.
And you.
Jews and Jewish identity is a complicated thing at times. When Jews have been living away from a Jewish community or in an area where supposedly there aren't any Jews, there isn't any organized Jewish life, they can lose their identity, but they can retrieve it as well. You have a friend in a place you talked about a lot, Montenegro, who has worked to recreate, really starting from scratch about 8 years ago, the Jewish community there. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, kind of a obscure Jewish community that more or less disappeared.
Right. We can talk about Montenegro, and separately we can have a conversation about Ukraine as well.
Okay.
Issues are similar in that they were both communist countries. Different in that Montenegro over the centuries has been divided and redivided and defined and redefined, and it's belonged to the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire and Greater Serbia, which was the former Yugoslavia. So even the concept of Montenegro is difficult, and it's really two different countries. It's the coastal strip that has gorgeous resorts and beaches and fortified towns that were built by the Venetians when they ran a powerful maritime empire all through the Adriatic. So those look exactly like Dubrovnik. And the most beautiful one in Montenegro today is Kotor,
yep. Been there,
which had gorgeous. Historically a Jewish community, right, when it was part of Venice. Well, the rule of empires goes back much further because the Greeks settled the coast. They came by boat, obviously. Nobody crossed the mountains in those days. And the inland of Montenegro is very high. It's up very steep mountains, and it's hard to move people or equipment up those mountains into. So that's basically settled by different people. In the ancient times, the coast was the Illyrians, the inland was Slavs. But the Greeks had a foothold on that coast. then, of course, part of the Roman Empire and the eastern half of the Roman Empire became the Byzantine Empire, but the dividing line, which was defined by Diocletian late in the 3rd century, went right through the middle of Montenegro. So the like northwestern extremity of Montenegro that was always part of Venice became Roman Catholic, which was sort of natural. The eastern part became Orthodox, which it still is today. So historically, during these various empires, the Greeks, the Byzantines, the Venetians, the Ottomans further inland, Montenegro had Jewish settlements, synagogues, Jewish life, but it didn't have an organized Jewish community. And even when I worked frequently in the former Yugoslavia during the 1970s, in my years as the Officer for Education and Culture for the World Union of Jewish Students, even then, Montenegro, quote unquote, had no Jews. Now, that has changed radically in the past few years, and the story of that change we'll deal with next week.
Tom, thanks very much. A good year, Shana Tova.
Also to you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Jewish doctor, a Jewish engineer, and a Jewish lawyer are discussing who has the oldest profession. The doctor says, in Genesis, it says God took a rib from Adam and created Eve. That's surgery. So medicine's the oldest profession. The engineer answers, in Genesis, it says God created order out of chaos. That's engineering. I'm in the oldest profession. And the lawyer says, who do you think created chaos? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a great Torah portion on Yom Kippur, which explores holiness and commitment to God. In Reformed tradition, tomorrow morning we'll read from the portion of Nitzavim, affirming that we have the responsibility in this great season of Yom Kippur to choose life and God. In the afternoon, we'll chant from Kedoshim, the Holiness Code, teaching us how to be holy through living sacred and moral lives. The next festival on the Jewish autumn holiday calendar, Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, is easy to overlook in the fast flow of fall festivals. Yom Kippur is followed just 4 days later by the Harvest Holiday, whose principal observances are based in an earlier age, the agricultural celebration of bringing in the fruits, vegetables, and grains that carry us through a barren winter. In today's world, where food comes from across the globe and virtually any kind of produce is available year-round, a particular week to celebrate reaping the rewards of the natural world might seem, well, archaic. But the move in recent years to seek locally sourced produce and grains produced through sustainable agricultural methods from native seeds, finding fruits, vegetables, and other natural products at farmers' markets and through growers' cooperatives, testifies to an understanding that what we produce from the ground nearby, with God's help, is usually the best food to eat and serve to our children. There is nothing tastier than ripe, fresh fruits and vegetables harvested recently at the proper time and season. They taste better and offer health and environmental benefits as well for us and the planet. Perhaps that's just the way God intended us to live. For our ancestors in ancient Israel, Sukkot was considered the most important observance of all, called Hechag, the holiday in the Mishnah, as though it were the only one. Of all the festivals, this is the one most often referred to in the Bible, and it must have been the one on which most people came to Jerusalem to express gratitude to God. Sukkot in ancient Jerusalem would have been an incredible scene. Sukkahs all over the city, songs and feasts for the full week. Today our focus on Sukkot is on thanksgiving to God for the bounty of the harvest. This season, known as Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, is blessed with Torah readings focusing on the rituals of the ancient festival, with some additional mystical passages. Here, too, the Torah reminds us we exist solely through the grace of God. We offer thanks for the natural world that God created to help provide for our needs. A good reminder this week, and always, Sukkot begins Friday night. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Ken Spiro, helps us see Jewish history as a dynamic and exciting part of life. Find out why when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg lay in state at the U.S. Supreme Court and Capitol Building last week, and memorial services and remembrances were conducted by rabbis and others. A battery of current and former clerks accompanied Justice Ginsburg's coffin up the steps of the Supreme Court, where she lay in repose for 2 days before lying in state for a day at the Capitol across the street. Ginsburg is the first Jew and the first woman to lie in repose at the court and to lie in state at the Capitol. Ginsburg died just before Rosh Hashanah. She served as Associate Justice on the nation's highest court from 1993 until, well, now, and was a groundbreaking advocate for gender rights and equality, overcoming extreme bias against women in the legal field on a variety of occasions herself. Ginsburg rose to become universally respected for her judicial accomplishment, brilliance, work ethic, kindness, and personal generosity of spirit. It has been said that she did more for women in America than virtually any other single person. Nita Totenberg, the NPR Supreme Court correspondent and Ginsburg's friend and a past guest of Too Jewish, abandoned her usual legal analysis for a Jewish explanation. A Jewish teaching says that those who die just before the Jewish New Year are the ones God has held back until the last moment because they were needed most and were the most righteous, Totenberg wrote. So it was that RBG died as the sun was setting last night, marking the beginning of Rosh Hashanah. While that's a loose reinterpretation of Jewish tradition, it captured the feelings of many. Lauded in recent years as the notorious RBG, she embraced her late-life celebrity, the feisty, workout-devoted octogenarian Supreme Court justice, who morphed in the past decade from admired legal trailblazer to beloved feminist pop icon, was the subject of a Hollywood biopic, a documentary, Saturday Night Live sketches, and late-night interviews, not to mention T-shirts, mugs, memes, and bobbleheads. Ruth Bader was the daughter of a Jewish Brooklyn furrier and his garment worker wife, and showed academic promise from the beginning. She graduated first in her class at Cornell, married and had children while attending law school at Harvard with her husband Martin. At Harvard Law, she was one of just 9 women in a class of 500 experiencing gender discrimination firsthand when professors chastised her for taking a man's spot at Harvard Law. She served as the first female member of Harvard Law Review. When her husband graduated and took a legal position in New York, Ginsburg transferred to Columbia Law School, joining their law review and finishing first in her class there, too. In spite of her stellar academic record at great schools, gender bias made it difficult for her to find a job until a Columbia professor insisted that a U.S. District Court judge hire her as a clerk. She eventually moved into academia, first at Rutgers Law School and then Columbia Law, where she became the first female professor at Columbia to earn tenure. Ginsburg also directed the influential Women's Rights Project of the ACLU during the 1970s. In this position, she led the fight against gender discrimination and successfully argued 6 landmark cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg experienced her share of gender discrimination even in her professional career, going so far as to hide her pregnancy from her Rutgers colleagues. Ginsburg accepted Jimmy Carter's appointment to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in 1980. She served on the court for 13 years until 1993, when Bill Clinton appointed her to the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg began her career as a Supreme Court justice, where she left off as an advocate, fighting for women's rights. In 1996, she wrote the majority opinion in the U.S. versus Virginia, holding that qualified women could not be denied admission to the Virginia Military Institute. Her style on the bench matched her style from her time at the ACLU, slow but steady and calculated. Instead of creating sweeping limitations on gender discrimination, she attacks specific areas of discrimination and violation of women's rights one at a time, sending a message to legislatures on what they could and couldn't do. Her attitude was that major social change should not come from the courts, but from Congress and other legislatures. The tributes from her colleagues on the Supreme Court were extraordinary. Perhaps the most beautiful came from Justice Clarence Thomas, her ideological opposite in many ways, who said, "Through the many challenges, both professionally and personally, she was the essence of grace, civility, and dignity. She was a superb judge who gave her best and exacted the best from each of us, whether in agreement or disagreement. And as outstanding as she was as a judge, she was an even better colleague, unfailingly gracious, thoughtful, and civil." Justice Stephen Breyer said, "I heard of Ruth's death while I was reciting the mourner's Kaddish at the Rosh Hashanah Eve service. I thought, a great justice, a woman of valor, a rock of righteousness, and my good, good friend. The world is a better place for her having lived in it, and so is her family, her friends, the legal community, and the nation." Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave her granddaughter one final statement in the days before her death, "My most fervent wish is that I will not be replaced until a new president is installed." And while the Talmud says in Masechet Gittin, it is a mitzvah to fulfill the wishes of the dead, it is clear that this is not the intent of the president or the Republican majority in the Senate, regardless of precedent. Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt began the Supreme Court memorial service with Psalms and ended with the Elmolei Rachamim, the prayer for the dead. Chief Justice John Roberts closed the brief ceremony with a eulogy. Ginsburg's life was one of the many versions of the American dream. Her father was an immigrant from Odessa. Her mother was born 4 months after her family arrived from Poland. Her mother later worked as a bookkeeper in Brooklyn. Ruth used to ask, "What's the difference between a bookkeeper in Brooklyn and a Supreme Court justice?" Her answer, "One generation." May her memory be a blessing. Zecher Tzadikah Livracha. In other news, after live streaming for about 23 minutes on YouTube, the roundtable conversation from San Francisco State University featuring Palestinian hijacker Leila Khaled suddenly went dark. "This video has been removed for violating YouTube's terms of service," read a message. The live stream had 900 viewers when it was shut down, abruptly ending when an old video of Khaled was shown in which she defended her activities as a terrorist. "People have the right to fight for those who occupy their land by any means possible, including weapons," Khaled said right before YouTube stopped the feed. Titled "Whose Narratives? Gender, Justice, and Resistance," the virtual discussion was organized by San Francisco State's Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies Department. It was to include a talk by Khaled as well as a conversation afterwards with her. The day before the event, Zoom announced Khaled's participation would violate company policy. It would not allow its platform to be used. Zoom disabled the link, and the Facebook link where people could sign up became inactive the morning of the event, leaving organizers scrambling to find a platform. An associate professor, Rabab Abdul Hadi, served as moderator. He said that Zoom removed the event link and later reported YouTube pulled the plug during the conversation. Leila Khaled was part of a team that hijacked TWA Flight 840 on its way from Rome to Tel Aviv in August 1969. A year later, she participated in the attempted hijacking of an El Al flight from Amsterdam to New York as part of a series of simultaneous hijackings carried out by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Khaled was arrested as a terrorist in London, where the pilot diverted the plane, and later released in exchange for hostages freed from another Palestinian terrorist hijacking. She now lives in Amman, Jordan, but she did not get to talk. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Ken Spiro, a senior lecturer and researcher for Eshat Torah Jerusalem, a licensed tour guide for the Israel Ministry of Tourism, went to Vassar College with a bachelor's in Russian language and literature, did graduate studies at the Pushkin Institute in Moscow. You may be the only American-born tour guide with that on his resume, I suspect, in Israel. Master's in history from the Vermont College of Norwich University and smicha from Yeshiva Eish HaTorah Jerusalem. Can you tell us a little bit about your approach to Jewish history? You know, we typically teach Jewish history as a series of disasters from one end of the planet to the other, followed by this redemptive experience of the State of Israel. How do you think about Jewish history?
Reminds me of that joke about a summary of all Jewish holidays. They tried to kill us. We won.
Let's eat. Exactly.
So when I'm teaching history, I'm trying to incorporate. I always tell people I wear two hats. I wear like the rabbi hat, and I also wear the historian hat. And by the way, history, Jewish history, is the big black hole for most Jews, even very well educated Jews. They don't know their history. So I try and combine the two in a very interesting way, because what we Jews introduced into the world, one of our unique innovations, is this idea of one God, which has not only had a huge impact on morality, you know, as some people call it ethical monotheism, which has been an incredibly transformative idea in terms of values, morality, and spirituality, but it also introduced the idea of an infinite, all-powerful, all-knowing being that acts in history. And that there's a history is a control process leading to a destination. It's called determinism. And it's a fascinating way of studying and teaching history, because rather than looking at history as we're just stumbling through a series of events that have no beginning, no middle, no end, and no real purpose, we, the human race, is all in a story, and the Jewish people have a unique role to play in that story. And not only that, I also, because you know, the same infinite intelligence that put laws into science, like gravity, that allow us to survive in this world in a predictable way, because we know if we do X, Y will happen. There's also laws in history. There's patterns. There's rules to the game. So as soon as you can explain to people that you're part of a very unique nation with unique responsibility in the ultimate story, his story, and that there are rules to the game that you need to learn, because they're all laid out. The beginning of Jewish history, the book of Genesis, I always say, is like the playbook. And if you pay attention, you know, you understand who Abraham is, you understand who we are as a people, his drive, his mission, his strengths. There are strengths throughout history. You know, you study stories like Isaac living with the Philistines or Joseph in Egypt. You get all the rules of the game of the incredible roller coaster ride we've had interacting with the non-Jewish world for millennia. And so on. There's just so many patterns. So that's the approach I take, which I think is fairly unique. And I think gives people it's a great way of teaching people the Jewish worldview.
Tell us a little more about Eishet Torah. You know, many of us have been to Jerusalem many times, seen the big yeshiva in the old city, without really understanding its approach to outreach. People know Chabad because it's ubiquitous. People may know their own Reform, Conservative, Orthodox backgrounds, or their own secular tradition, but Eish is an unusual aspect of contemporary Judaism.
Yes, so Eishet Torah was founded by a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Noach Weinberg, who was originally from New York, who came to Israel in the 50s. He passed away actually 11 years ago, but his whole... And he was quite a groundbreaker in that when he, you know, in the 50s, 60s, this is when Jews were mainstreaming into American society, and the trend was to move away from Judaism, which is a trend that unfortunately still plagues the Jewish world and the American Jewish community until today. His idea was Judaism is like wisdom for living. Everyone needs wisdom, and everyone wants to live a complete, full, pleasurable life. So his idea was to take, you know, the beauty of Judaism and to translate it into a way that's understandable, and to really reintroduce Jews to their destiny, their spirituality, their religion, God, all the things that most Jews are kind of on autopilot about. You know, most Jews look at Judaism as some, you know, sort of like kind of sweet, nice cultural thing, bagels, lox, and cream cheese. But his whole thing was really to show the power and the meaning of and the message of Judaism is a transformative force, not only in an individual's life, but also in the life of the entire Jewish nation, and how we have a unique responsibility in the world. He started a small educational organization in the Old City. He actually tried many different organizations. He eventually opened Aish in 1975, and it has expanded and contracted throughout its history. When the Soviet Union fell apart, we had 12 branches. I actually got to use my Russian for that. We had 12 branches in the former Soviet Union, which today don't exist anymore because all those Jews have since left and come to Israel or America. But it's basically an international outreach organization whose central base is in the Old City of Jerusalem, And now, for the last few years, a beautiful building right opposite the Western Wall, which I would recommend all of your listeners, please God, when they open up tourism again, to come and check out the view from the roof. It's really quite special.
It is a spectacular location. You wrote an interesting book, jumping back to Jewish history a little bit, comparing Jewish history to a series of Hollywood epics. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, my most recent book, it's the third book I wrote, is called Destiny. I happen to love movies. I love epic movies, you know, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Star Wars, The Matrix, those kind of movies that are, and I noticed watching so many of them that they all have a commonality of plot. Sometimes they take place in a galaxy far, a long time ago, far, far away. Sometimes they take place in Middle Earth, but there's always a little superhero. The world always has somehow descended into darkness. The little superhero doesn't even know he's a little superhero. He doesn't want the job. There's a big bad guy. The little superhero is sort of pushed into a role that even if he doesn't want, he can't escape because his role is central to the whole process of saving whatever needs to be saved, whether it's the galaxy, the universe, the planet, the country. He has a series of encounters with the big bad guy that are, you know, he should have lost many times over because he's so outgunned and outnumbered. He always manages to pull through, sometimes barely. And in the end, there's always a final showdown between a little superhero, whether it's Frodo or Harry Potter, and the big bad guy, whether it's Voldemort or Saruman. And he always wins, and good triumphs, evil's destroyed, and the balance is restored. And then I looked at Jewish history because I like to kind of stand back and look at it holistically. And I said, really, you could take those story beats that make up every one of these epic Hollywood movies, and you see that really Jewish history, you could check off every one. That's Jewish history. We are the little superhero, although we're not just one person. This is the Jewish people over many thousands of years and many generations. But we're a seemingly insignificant in terms of our size, but super important force that play a central role in this incredible drama of human history. And I just use that as a sort of a model to work in a lot of important concepts dealing with things like the understanding of the Jewish impact on the world. Why are Jews so disproportionately impactful? What really drives anti-Semitism? What is the Jewish scenario for what's supposed to happen at the end of the story, which is the part we haven't reached yet? So it's a way of giving people kind of a big picture of what it's called destiny, you know, what our destiny is about, and also dealing with some of the really big issues. You know, things like anti-Semitism are huge and only getting worse in the world. And most people have no understanding of what really drives this seemingly irrational, longest, most universal, most violent hatred in human history.
Well, not just seemingly irrational. It is irrational. That doesn't mean it stops or it ever really disappears at any period. What's your favorite period in Jewish history?
Well, I could say the present because there's a lot of interesting things going on, but I have to say, in reality, what I like the most is Second Temple period. It's not that it's a good period of time in Jewish history. It's one of the darkest, but I specifically love the period of time of the Second Temple and Roman occupation of the land of Israel. Anything related to that period of time, I am particularly fascinated with.
In many ways, that's the most visible part, especially if you're, you know, right across from the Kotel or something, you know, you're sort of seeing it right there. When you take groups around Israel, what do you change to keep yourself fresh? Do you do the same kind of tour each time? How do you do it?
Well, actually, you know, it's not, obviously, there's something new to talk about. I always, when I'm guiding, kind of tailor what I'm talking about to the audience. If it's a bar mitzvah group, I'm going to focus on the bar mitzvah kid and talk about that. If I have a bunch of academics and a bunch of non-Jews, obviously evangelical Christians want to hear something different from very religious Jews visiting from Borough Park in Brooklyn. But honestly, I find that, like, just like with history, if it's something that you love and you're interested in, I can teach it over. It's just like teaching the same class. You know, if I do it five times in one day, I might be a little bit of a burnout. If I were to visit Masada 10 times in a week, it would be kind of not only kind of hot and exhausting, but it might get a little bit, you know, difficult to do. But generally speaking, I find that it's so interesting, and I love it so much, and I'm so into it that I don't really need to, like, keep it. It stays fresh on its own in my mind all the time.
When you were preparing your crash course in Jewish history, you know, how do you decide what to include and what not to include?
Well, that's a great topic because it's a big book, but it's dealing with, you know, 3,700 years of Jewish history. But I based it on, actually, I wrote that book in a very interesting way. I actually based it on the classes I taught, because I wanted to keep my voice. When you write things, you tend to overthink them. And if you just speak them out, you know, you have to fact make sure everything you say is correct. But it comes in a little more fresh and more like a story and more narrative. And I just worked my way through Jewish history, trying to cover all the periods, but specifically focusing on, just as I, you know, I said before, I'm kind of focusing on the meaning and the message. So while I'm going to try and touch on as much as I can in a book that's almost 400 pages long, but when you're dealing with 4,000 years, that's not so much, that's not so many pages.
Yeah, yeah, what's 400
pages? But
to really
focus on
3,000 years.
Yeah, but to really try and focus on, you know, like certain themes that repeat themselves throughout history to sort of demonstrate, like scientifically, cause and effect. You have experimentation, observation, hypotheses. So I'm going to take certain themes that I'm going to lay out at the beginning, and I'm going to revisit them as I go, as we go through this amazing journey of Jewish history, to show that these are clear patterns that we have the ability to act collectively in a certain way, A, X, and Y will happen as a result. And that's what I really want my students to understand and my readers to understand. Is it's the lessons we learn, because we're still in the story. The end is coming close. And now more than ever, we, you know, I always say you can't represent the Jewish people till you know what the Jewish people represent. And ignorance is as great a threat to us as anti-Semitism in many ways. So, and one of the most important places to begin is by getting an overview of our history and understanding the lessons we need to learn from it.
So as a Jewish historian, teacher, has there ever been a time when Jews knew less about their own history than right now?
I don't know how. I don't think that most of Jewish history, Jews have been that well versed in their history, but I don't think there's ever been a time where so many Jews have been so disconnected from Judaism in general, which is not just the history, and that for sure will suffer more than other things, but just from a connection to Jewish identity. In America, it's a huge percentage of Jews in the United States are frighteningly ignorant of everything about Judaism.
And the way to fix that is?
Well, the way to fix that is sort of going back to what I think my rabbi who founder of Eshet Torah, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, you have to show people that it's meaningful and relevant. And this, you know, relevant to whether it's how to have a happy marriage, how to raise healthy kids, how to feel like you have a meaningful existence, and you're part of a story, whatever, anything, everyone is lit up by something different. But I think everyone wants happiness and everyone wants meaning. And Judaism is like the perfect product to give a person exactly those two things. So if you can show people that it's not just clinging to ancient, outdated ritual or not giving Hitler a posthumous victory by assimilating and things like that, which are all negative, but rather that there's tremendous positivity and much to be gained from on so many levels being connected Jewishly, then that's how you light people up and get them interested and sell what is an incredible product. We have one of the oldest family businesses on the planet Earth. We just need to market it.
It's a great expression. Ken, where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about your work and your books?
So I have a comprehensive website. It's easy to remember. It's kenspiro, kenspiro.com. And all my content is online for free. You can listen, read, and watch. And also, if people want to get the books, there's links to Amazon and the ebooks. It's all there. And people can also contact me if they have questions or they want to know a specific question about Jewish history or a book to read. They're welcome to write me.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And you and all your listeners should have a happy, healthy year, and we should have good news for not just the Jews, but for all of you.
For the whole world.
We need some of that.
From your mouth to God's ears.
We definitely need some of that.
Absolutely.
Amen.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days are, of course, here. You might have missed Rosh Hashanah, but Yom Kippur comes up tonight. Join Beit Simcha for our blended online and very limited live seating. You can call 520-276-5675 or email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are normally open to everyone in these days of coronavirus sorus. Join us every Friday night, including this Shabbat of Sukkot, on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat Sukkot services this week are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. We'll hold services with full music by virtual experience weekly for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access them by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information, or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Find out about our services, great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and incredible array of adult education academy courses, all taught on Zoom, and our services on Facebook. Call 520-276-5675 for Congregation Beit Simcha. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from, of course, the High Holy Days. Yom Kippur is tonight. Don't forget to make your arrangements to virtually attend Yom Kippur services at Congregation Beit Simcha with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Call 520-276-5675 or email youthed@beitsimchatucson.org. That's Y-O-U-T-H-E-D at B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A-Tucson.org, or go to our website. The playout this morning comes from Ne'ilah, the concluding service of Yom Kippur, a Sephardic piyud, liturgical poem, El Nora Alila, as performed by Chazan Ari Litvak and friends. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Lynn Sharon Schwartz, the award-winning author, discussing her new book, Truth Telling. It's a great book. Don't miss it. My friends, may you have a Gemara Chatima Tova, a good sealing into the Book of Life, we pray, and a healthy and safe week, God willing. A Shavua Tov, a good week and a week and a much better year, and a Chag Sameach this Friday, by the way, for Sukkot. All of that, we pray, a year of health and of peace.
El Nora Alila, El Nora Alila, Hamzilanu Mechila, Beshaat Aneila, El Nora Alila, El Nora Alila, Hamzilanu Mechila, Beshaat Aneila. Keruim lechaim noseim umesaldim bechila beshat aneila el nora lila el nora lila hamsilanu mechila beshat aneila el nora lila el nora lila hamsilanu mechila beshat aneila shovkim lechanaf sham מחפי שם בחחשם אמציאם מחילה בשעת הנעילה אל נורא לילה אל נורא לילה אמציאם
ממציא לנו מחילה בשעת הנעילה. שעת הנעילה
תזכו לשנים רבות הבנים והאבות וביצעו את העולה ושעת הנעילה
אל נור העלילה אל נור.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.